With all the challenges we've faced in recent years, it feels like we've all grown closer together. Yet sometimes, it also feels like we're a million miles apart. Like Paula Abdul sang once, we take two steps forward, two steps back. So how do we come together when opposites attract?
When comedian Kate Willett suddenly found herself wanting to date men again, after getting divorced from a woman, she wondered about what kind of place she could hold in her life for men and not let it get too weird. In her new audiobook, Dirtbag Anthropology, Kate Willett takes us on an intense roller coaster ride into the world of men. The series features hilarious and insightful conversations with comedians and experts and even Kate's own father.
Today, Kate Willett joins us to take a look at men, men, men. Listen as we chat with Kate about modern masculinity and how that nice guy doesn't always end up being so nice.
Plus, lots of hilarious animal news. Bart the zombie cat, who became internet famous in 2015 for surviving being buried alive, is doing amazing today.
Folks are smuggling songbirds from Africa to compete in American Idol bird singing competitions.
And Prancer, the mean little chihuahua that's a vessel for a haunted Victorian child, finds love in a new home.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Hello, this is Kate.
Hi, is this Kate Willett?
Yeah, hey.
Hi, Kate, this is Fausto.
And Mark from Feast of Fun. It's a pleasure to talk to you today.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Of course.
What are you wearing?
I got a paisley dress on, which is very cute. I've been rocking the paisley.
I love paisley.
Yeah.
Paisley originates from Persia, right?
I don't know where it comes from. I thought it came from the 60s, but maybe that. Yeah.
Well, I think it came in through the whole guru, you know.
The Beatles.
The Beatles, all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
I was admiring your outfit on Stephen Colbert where you made your TV debut appearance right before the pandemic struck.
Right before the pandemic, yeah. Wow. And I was so excited about that dress. I was like, this dress is going to skyrocket me to all my dreams coming true. And then instead there was the coronavirus.
I can imagine it must have been a really exciting opportunity to go on a major television program. And, you know, the question inevitably that all comedians ask themselves is, what am I going to look like? What am I going to wear?
I knew I wanted to wear red.
Yeah.
Because the blue background for that show, I like looked at other sets that people had on, different outfits, and to me, the color that most like popped with the blue was red. There were a couple other comedians that had really cute outfits, and plus red is one of my favorite colors for dresses. Yeah, I really had like a pretty kind of specific idea of what I wanted to wear. Like I wanted to wear something that had like a little bit of a, you know, kind of a slightly hippie vibe, but in like a, because that's my vibe, but it had to be like sort of formal because it was late night. And so I searched around until I found something and I was like, yes, this is the dress. And then I ordered it, had to get it altered and stuff because I think they only had it in like a size that was like too big for me. Mm-hmm. So I had to go to the alteration lady and yeah, but I have done the thing where I have, you know, had to call people and be like, what should I wear? What should I wear? But for that one, I was like, no, I know what I should wear for this.
Well, because, you know, we're all feminists here. We also appreciate a good pair of high heel shoes. And I was like, you know, like, was it Dominique Jackson was like, look at the shoes,
get
mama.
Get the shoes, baby. Baby, get the shoes. Get the shoes, baby. Get, let's, every time she's photographed, they're always, you know, showgirls always want to show the shoes.
And this is my number one thing to every advice to everybody. If you're going to be on TV, learn from the girls from RuPaul's Drag Race. Dress up, honey. It's show business. And you look so good. And your legs look fierce in those pumps. And your hair was gorgeous. And your eye makeup was on point. And I was like, she's a star.
Aw. Yeah, it was so much fun.
Yeah.
In this past year, you've been putting together an audiobook that examines your relationships to men, because for a while you had disavowed men for life being in a relationship with a woman.
Yeah, I mean, it was a thing where, like, I just kind of, so, you know, I was in a relationship with a woman that I knew from high school, and we started dating when I was, like, 18 and dated and got got married were legally domestic partners. So I was like 25. And I think during a lot of that time, you know, I was living in the Bay Area in Berkeley, and I was like, oh, you know, I don't like straight guys. I can just basically never hang out with them again. It doesn't really have to be part of my reality because I'm not like romantically affiliated. I don't necessarily have to be friends with them. So, you know, my life was pretty much like women and queer people.
Well, and we all want to sort of like surround ourselves with people who appreciate and understand us and lower the friction of everyday life. You know, like Mark and I have been working on starting a new podcast that explores like fitness and bodybuilding for gay men and LGBTQ people. And I'm just like noticing, like, I don't even have a word for it, I guess, bro culture. Whereas like, it's like you guys could be so much more fun to be around if you just crack a joke every now and then.
Yeah, totally.
You know, and part of it is like, and I'm noticing this from, you know, listening to your work, is that there is this kind of like heightened tension between heterosexual relationships, which LGBTQ people can have them too. Mm-hmm. And where people are like wanting to be very courteous and, but also are concerned about holding themselves accountable. And in Kate, in terms of like your adventures in sort of looking at the relationships with men, what is the, like the first thing that you kind of learned about this journey back into talking to your father and to other men about men in general?
Can you repeat the last part of the question?
Let's talk about men. What did you learn about like in putting together? You have this complete book called Dirtbag Anthropology, where you're looking at relationships, you know, toxic masculinity, relationships with men. What did like the biggest insight that you discovered?
So I feel like there's a few things that I don't know. So that's the big question, right? Mm-hmm. So when I kind of think about the process of writing this book, I originally started with like, all right, what are the expectations that we should be having of men, straight guys, especially in a post Me Too world, you know, like beyond like, hey, please stop sexually harassing people, you know, which should be a given, you would think, you know.
It's so hard for people, especially men, to hear the word no.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and the entitlement that they feel towards other people's bodies is just, you know, repulsive.
And that's definitely true for a lot of men, you know. But there's also, like, I think a bunch of guys who are really just kind of trying to be good, and they don't want to make anyone uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. They're just kind of trying to do whatever they think the right thing is, but feel really unsure what the right thing is. And so I wanted to write something for guys like that. And it started that way. But then over the process of writing the book, engaging with the question of what does it mean to be a good man, I just kind of really hit a point where I decided that it's not like too different than the question of what does it mean to be a good person. I ended up thinking a lot in this book about empathy and integrity, what honesty means, and not so much like, you know, what is the specific like masculine expression of those qualities, but more like how do cultural conceptions of masculinity block both men and women from being able to like have those qualities be really present in our relationships with each other, if that makes sense.
My mother told me this at a very young age. You have to seek out healthy parental role models throughout the course of your life to fully grow up and be a self-actualized person.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. That's a great way of putting it. It's like, you know, you find your chosen family when you're an adult.
Your surrogate mother and surrogate father, or surrogate non-binary parent. And part of that is like, we have such a complicated relationship with men. For gay men, it's been like, you know, being bullied in high school. It's about young love and that relationship not working out. Like, I hear this from especially a lot of young gay guys that I know. They're like, I hate men. I'm like, well, do you hate yourself? You know, and I'm saying, like, I totally understand that frustration. But, you know,
well, men are terrible.
Seek out those healthy parental relationships so you can overcome the trauma and, you know, surround yourself with people who are going to cultivate and nurture you and get excited about you.
Mm hmm.
And you found that in Margaret's show, right? Doesn't she call you like her drag daughter? I mean, comedian daughter.
We call it drag daughters or drag mothers is when like an artist who cultivates or takes an interest in your personal development.
Yeah, Margaret was definitely a really important person like that for me.
Yeah.
There were also some other people like that in my life, and all of them were... You know,
what are you
difference
eating, by the way? it sounds delicious.
I just took a sip of bar.
What?
No, I just took a sip of kombucha and it was like really sour for a second. I thought it was going to be like just like drinking water, but then all of a sudden it was like really lemony. So I'm super sorry.
Yeah, we used to brew kombucha for years in our home. And like everybody was like terrified because the mold.
The mother. The SCOBY.
The SCOBY that floats on top sometimes looks very vaginal, you know?
Yeah, but also a chicken
it's
breast.
Very vaginal, yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And people are like, what is this like face hugger floating on tea from aliens? What are you doing there?
You know, and the people are like, I think it's talking to me.
Yeah, it's kind of like squid-like. It's very squid-like. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you cut off a piece and you give it to your friend and be like, it died. I'm sorry.
What? You want me to do what, SCOBY? I don't think I could do that. I don't think that would be right.
Kill again?
Where are we going to hide the body?
But you live in Brooklyn, so you have to drink kombucha, right?
Yeah, I'm a huge kombucha fan.
Yeah.
I just really like it. It's kind of gross, but
it's tart.
What I like about it. And you know, to be honest, it's not altogether dissimilar from my relationship with straight men. You know, like, wow, this is disgusting, but that's part of the charm.
You and my sibling, Talia, have a lot in common because Talia, like throughout the course of their life, has identified first as a lesbian and been mostly in sex relationships with women, but then, you know, started exploring relationships with men. Mm-hmm. And now this past year came out as non-binary.
Mm.
And that's so cool.
There is this shared experience that some people have where their relationships, their adventures in life sometimes lead them to same-sex relationships or heterosexual relationships. And those dynamics can sometimes be really complicated, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely.
And you started dating so you were like in a relationship with a comedian, I guess, that you were like not wanting to have, or he didn't want to have a relationship with you.
So I did date a comedian during the pandemic a lot, and we broke up like a couple months ago. And, you know, I'm not going to lie. I definitely think that masculinity did play a role in like part of what was stressful about our relationship. Like some of it was, we had really different expectations of like, just how we would deal with like a really difficult situation, like a pandemic. Like I'm a very like external processor in terms of like, you know, talking about feelings and stuff, like as women are often taught to be. And he was like a very like go in his cave guy, as like, you know, men are often taught to be, you know. And so like, yeah, I think that was part of it. I also think that like, you know, male comedians, I just they're kind of like feral cats or something, where you're like, they want to come inside, they want some food, but then they're like, it's time for me to go go back outside now, you know?
Well, how do you even date during a pandemic? Is it Zoom dates? Or are you actually like, I've been, you know, oh, let's mask up and go for a walk?
Well, so actually it was really weird because he and I were dating for like 3 weeks before the pandemic hit. And then when the pandemic hit, my roommates, two ladies I was living with, they both moved back to their respective states, which were Georgia and California. And so I was in the apartment all alone. And he's like, well, you know, like, I'll come stay with you. So he So our first like couple months of dating were just him staying with me, maybe first like 3 months. Mm-hmm. And so we like kind of started by living together and then kind of scaled it back as time went on, you know, which is like,
so you're like, we can go outside now, so you need to go back to your apartment for a little while. Is that how it was?
Yeah. I mean, it was just like kind of weird because we had like the reverse progression of a relationship where we like started by living together, and then by the time we were, you know, a year in, it was like, okay, we see each other, you know, 2-3 times a week. And that was just a really weird way to have a relationship.
Well, it's almost like you guys, like, you were shipwrecked on an island during the pandemic.
Yeah. And I don't want to make it sound too bad because, yeah, like, ultimately, like, you know, it was, I'm really grateful for the fact that, like, we both had someone to get through that really stressful time
you started dating men when you were starting your comedy career. Was it because it's funnier to make fun of men than it is to make fun of women? Is that kind of
so yeah, I think so. I mean, like, for some reason I don't feel as comfortable making fun of women, and I don't know why. Like, that could be because it's like I'm a bisexual, and like there's part of me that's like, you know, it's why would I make fun of women in a world where there's like already so much misogynistic humor? And, you know, like the things about the women that I've dated anyway that I would want to make fun of, like, they're all very specific to that individual woman, you know? Whereas, like, the things about, like, men, like, that I would make fun of, like, there's some sort of, like, social underpinning to it, you know?
Yeah, because, like, the U-Haul joke is, like, it's too tired now, right?
Oh, my God. If I get another lesbian U-Haul joke, I'm going to throw myself out of the window.
And how many cat jokes can you make, you know?
Well, I have two cats that live with me, and I'm fully, like, making cat jokes all the time. But yeah, I don't know. I also feel like there's something like when I date women, like I want to like show up as like a very, like, as the best version of myself that I could possibly be, you know, because there's like an empathy, I think, where I'm like, okay, well, like, I think women deserve to be treated well, so, like, I better do it, you know? And then, but, like, I was, especially in my late 20s, I was in a time in my life where, like, I was a mess. I didn't feel particularly capable of treating anyone super well, including myself.
Oh, so then you're like, oh, date men.
Yeah, exactly, because I'm like, all right, well, you know, I might not be calling them back, but they don't really deserve to be called back, so, you know?
Yeah. Speaking of cats, did you ever hear about Zombie Cat, Bart the Zombie Cat? Some guy, I guess.
No, I've never heard of Bart the Zombie Cat.
His cat got hit, right? And he assumed it was dead, and so he buried it. And then, like, 5 days later, it crawled back up out of the ground, and somebody rescued it and took it to the vet. And, you know, I guess the guy had also reported it, like, it had gotten hit. So he wasn't being malicious or anything like that. And they had to, like, take maggots out of its eyes. They had to do all sorts of surgeries. They had to intubate it, and they had to feed it and whatnot. But, you know, 5 years later, the cat's, like, doing fine. And so they've rebranded it from Zombie Cat to Miracle Cat.
But there's more to the story.
Oh, there is?
Yeah, because the owner got into a legal dispute when the cat got famous with its adopter, who was a woman who was working at the Humane Society of Tampa Bay. And so he's like, you know, this is kind of reminds me of my, you know how parents have origin stories of where their kids come from?
Yeah.
Have you ever heard this? Like, you know,
like I was born in a cabbage patch.
Right.
My parents found me there. Where were you found? Did they tell you anything like that?
I think my mom actually told me about sex, and the way that she told me about it when I was very tiny is she told me that mom and dad had a special cuddle to make me, which is like way more disgusting than if she just was like, we had sex.
Yeah. Okay, that special cuddle is gonna stick in my brain for a while. Thank you for that.
Yeah, it's so gross. It's such a gross phrase.
And then, you know, of course, when somebody's trying to give you a hug, you're like, I don't want a baby.
Well, you know what they told me? Mm-hmm. They told me, well, because I was in Christian school too. So I think they told me that part of it was that you prayed and that God gave you a baby. Oh. And I remember I was like in fifth grade, someone told me that her mom was not married when she had her. And I said, that's impossible because God wouldn't give you a baby if you were not married. If you prayed for a baby, but you were not married, God would be like, no.
Christians, it's so...
Like, well, yeah.
Christians are like that. I was an adult. I was in college. I'm working in a restaurant. I'm the youngest of eight kids. The guy who's the dishwasher says to me, do you have any nieces and nephews? And I looked at it. I said, no, I don't have any nieces and nephews. Nobody in my family's married. And he just started laughing. And I'm like, what's so funny that he turns to the dishwasher, tells the story, and then he started laughing too. And I'm just like, oh, now I get it. We're so naive when we grow up sometimes, huh? But Fausto was found in a dumpster.
Well, so this is my father and we grew up in Puerto Rico, and you know, back in the 80s, there was the government actually ran one of the hotels, Caribe Hilton. One of the Hilton hotels had an arrangement with the Puerto Rican government to basically you know, share revenues and space, because they part of the hotel is on actual like state park land. And so the hotel grounds are open to the public. So my father would take us to the hotel park and we would have fun and walk around and play in the little garden. And there was a dumpster by the restaurant there. My father would always point that out, that he found us in the dumpster like zombie cat.
Well, because you're trash.
Because we're trash. And so he found us and he asked the chef, is this little boy belong to you? And the chef is like, that disgusting maggot covered. take it away. So my father took us home, bathed us and dressed us up in nice clothes. And then he brought us back to the park. And the chef was like, that boy belongs to me. He's like, nope, you threw him out. Now he's mine. And that's kind of what happened with Zombie Cat. Yeah. So there was this like lawsuit because Zombie Cat became a celebrity, and the owner wanted, just like a Grumpy Cat, mm-hmm. the owners wanted to like cash in mm-hmm. on the pet's fame. And so it was, and of course, they lost in court. So,
well, yeah, you bury your cat, you give up all rights, right?
Mm-hmm. So, Valerie.
It's like that guy who quit the Beatles, you know?
Oh, I feel so bad for him.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
There's a rumor that he was like in a gay relationship.
Right? The manager. Drop them.
Brian Epstein, but he was in a gay, like allegedly in a gay relationship with John Lennon.
Oh, and that's why they had to get rid of him.
They were like, you're too gay. This is going to be gay. Yeah. It's not going to work out.
There was also another viral cat that was in Brooklyn. Yeah. You live in Brooklyn, right? And the I guess a kid fell over the cat's leash and ended up killing.
Oh, I did not know that.
And ended up killing the cat. And then the family was, and the cat had some, you know, viral success, right? And so then the fan, like there's some video skirmish. And basically I think the cat owner said something about the kid, or I don't know exactly what happened, but then the family appears on this video to may have be attacking them for that and being like, you know, you're single and that's why you have a cat on a leash or something. Like it's wild. So it's developing news. So we'll cover it at some other point in time, but, cats.
Kate, I was very touched by this one story that you shared in your stand-up and on public radio about your crush on a young girl that moved away, and many years later, you guys like found each other.
Yeah, yeah.
How old were you when you guys met, like as children?
Two. It was in preschool.
So this is like a little. Tykes, right? And you guys were like best of friends, and then I guess the mother, the family of your friend had to move away, or you guys moved away?
No, they moved away. They moved away. Like to the other side of the country. Yeah. Mm.
And then I guess was it in your stand up and performance career that you like ran across her or got reconnected?
I just ran into her show, like maybe when I was few years into stand-up. Yeah, we just had both ended up living in San Francisco, and we recognized each other, which was wild because we hadn't seen each other since we were literally like 5 years old. We were so small when we separated.
And at what age did you reconnect with her?
30, maybe.
That's amazing.
Wow. Yeah.
How did she even like know to ask you? Like, has she been like in your mind, or did you guys like think about each other all those years?
Yeah, it was a thing where like, she came up to me after the show and said that she really liked my stand-up. Uh-huh. And I said, can I put you on my mailing list then? Because that was like a thing I was trying to do, mailing list.
Mailing lists are very, very, very important.
Yeah. And then I was like, you know, what's your name? And there was something about her that looked familiar. She's like, Aaron. And I was like, okay, my name's Katie Willett. And she's like, did you used to go by Katie? Which I did when I was a little kid. And I was just like, oh my God, where did you grow up? But she's like, Northridge. And we just both realized exactly what was going on. And we start crying because it was, it was like a thing that.
And then the music, so, love, leave us, love, will we belong.
Yeah. I mean, she totally recognized me too. We both recognized each other,
Did you kiss her when you got reconnected? Because she's also bisexual too, right?
Yeah, she's bisexual.
Was there some romance or no?
No, it was a platonic friendship. But then what happened is we started hanging out all the time and we became friends and we had a lot in common.
Was there a desire? Like part of you was like, oh my God, I found my soulmate.
No, it was it was a very sisterly connection. Mm-hmm. The vibes were it was like kind of a deep sisterhood, mm-hmm. And I was like telling her all about this guy that I was really hung up on at that time, and we weren't like together or anything, but like he was this guy that I was friends with and we had hooked up once and it had gone like really badly. And I was pretty devastated about the whole situation. I was really mad at him. I was confiding a lot in her about the situation because she didn't, she wasn't a comedian or anything. So I couldn't tell a lot of my other friends about it. And she was like listening to me. I was like, oh, it's so great to have this person in my life. Then I found out like maybe a month later or something after all that she had been like seeing him behind my back, which was like wild.
Ooh.
And she didn't tell me about it.
What a weird betrayal.
It was like not even the betrayal wasn't even so much that she was like kind of dating my friend. That would have been weird, but the thing that felt like a huge betrayal was that she had like listened to me like sort of mm-hmm. pour my heart out about how upset I was about this situation without like saying, oh, by the way, I'm like seeing him,
So do you think she was seeing him before you guys reconnected, or she started seeing him as you were telling him all these things?
No, as I was telling her all those things. Yeah. Ooh, they didn't know each other.
Single white female there.
She's white, but okay. It also was like this thing where I don't know. I think she was a very like competitive person always, even when we were really little. And I think it was like this thing where the fact that I liked him so much made her want to do it,
So does she have like a photo of you in her mirror and she's like, I'm going to crush you, Kate Willett?
I don't think so. I mean, she was like, not to be too hard on myself, but she's like way cuter than me. Like she's beautiful, beautiful. Could have had any guy,
So she's like, don't be jealous that I stole your man, girlfriend.
Well, it was just like this kind of thing where I confronted her about it. And I think that she was like, I think that she put like all the blame on him and was like, no, I didn't even like him. He was just pursuing me. And then I talked to him about it and he put all of the blame on her and was like, I didn't even like her. She was just pursuing me. And it was like this thing where I was like, okay, I'm never going to get to the truth here, but like neither of these people care about me as much as I would hope. So
what's the relationship like now? Is she still on your mailing list?
I actually haven't used my mailing list in a long time. I'm mostly doing like Twitter and Insta and stuff like that. Mailing lists have kind of fallen out of fashion. I did see her a few years ago. Because we have another mutual friend and we ended up hanging out, and I think she's married right now and has a kid. And it's one of those things where it's just like,
has she reached out to you about like, cause this thing, it's everywhere on the internet, this story, it seems, it's on YouTube videos and I heard it on NPR. So, has she heard it and been like, Thank you.
Well, like, this kind of reminds me of Carly Simon's song, You're So Vain.
Yeah. Did we ever figure out who that was about?
Well, it was rumored that it was about a woman. And in a lot of ways, we don't, you know, I'm sure a lot of your friends and fans don't know who this person is. And so everybody's like, well, it's about me. Of course, she can't get over me. You know,
well, that story is very specific about being a young child. So,
yeah. So
and I do believe the Carly Simon thing, she auctioned off who it was about. Right. And somebody paid money and she just whispered it into their ear.
So she finally confirmed it. And it's so boring. Warren Beatty.
When did she confirm it? Just now?
In recent times. Okay. When was that done? It was about 5 years ago.
Okay.
You know, so
about the same time as Zombie Cat.
Yeah. Zombie Cat was crawling out of the ground and Carly Simon said, Warren Beatty. And everyone's like, oh, I wanted something spicier.
Kate.
I can't even think about Warren Beatty without thinking about my grandma, because my grandma always called him Warner Beatty. And he was like one of her favorite actors. So she's like, I love Warner Beatty, you know?
We have to tell you the story. So we met Warren Beatty and Annette Bening's child at a blogger kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They're a trans blogger. And at the time, we didn't know who the person was. And we're standing there waiting for an elevator. And Fausto has a joke about, I used to joke that, hey, I'm a celebrity, you can trust me. And so Fausto kind of morphed that into like, hey, well, you know, if there's a celebrity, you know, they could do whatever they want.
You have to do what they tell you to do because they're a celebrity.
And so he's like,
and it was in reference to your drag mother, Margaret Cho.
Was it really?
Yeah. Oh, nice.
This was Stephen Ira, who's a very famous trans blogger. And we were talking about like celebrities. I had no idea who Stephen Ira was.
At the time.
And so I just said, listen, celebrities are right about everything. And you should just do whatever they tell you to do.
And they're like,
sarcastic.
Right. But their face was just kind of like,
do you know who I am?
What was it in reference to with Margaret Cho, though? I forget what it was. Do you remember?
Just, you know, that Margaret, I said, it's like, you guys probably would have a good friendship or relationship together. Right. Like, I was trying to like basically like be like, oh, you guys should date, you know? You'd be a good couple, Hollywood power couple. Mm-hmm. And Steve and I was like, do you know who I am?
Yeah.
And I was like, not a clue.
But so in your in Dirtbag Anthology, what is it, Anthropologist, you talk about a cool girl. And I haven't really come across that term. Is that like an internet term? And what is a cool girl to you?
Okay, so cool girl is not my term. That's from the novel Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn. Mm-hmm. Gillian Flynn or Gillian Flynn, but I think it's Gillian.
So that's the movie that had Ben Affleck in it, right?
And yeah.
It features Ben Affleck's penis in the movie.
Yeah.
For 4 seconds.
You know, so her description of cool girl is like, you know, woman who can eat a ton of hot dogs, but can stay a size 2, like just loves football, can, you know, just like loves like giving infinity blowjobs, mm-hmm. you know, basically like a guy's girl, but who is also like extremely hot, you know? And so the cool girl, the titular cool girl in Flynn's novel, she ends up, faking her own death to get her husband or her ex-husband arrested for murder. And, you know, but I think that this term, cool girl, was really popularized because I think it resonated at the time with a lot of people who are like, oh yeah, like there is this way that you're supposed to kind of contort yourself into something that fits male expectations in terms of like liking all the same stuff that men like, but you know, also being like constantly sexually available and constantly really beautiful. And what I was thinking mm-hmm. about, you know, in terms of like, in terms of this book, Dirtbag Anthropology, is like, okay, so, you know, we've had this like couple year cultural conversation about the cool girl, you know, what is that? But like a cool guy, like, the thing that makes him cool is like that he's living by his own set of rules. So whereas like a cool girl is somebody that's conforming to male expectations, like the cool guy is somebody that's conforming to his own expectations, and that what's cool about him is that he doesn't give a fuck, right? But that like to be a woman is to have to give a fuck in it.
Who's determining this? Is it incels on forums, or like who gets to define what cool is?
I mean, this was like my own observation about it, but you know what I was kind of observing, like, you know, in terms of like what my own markers were for like deciding a guy was cool is like, you know, is the guy somebody that's like that, you know, people like really want to be friends with and want to invite to parties and want to have sex with and like, you know, kind of consistently say really positive things about, you know, whatever the adult version of popular is, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel like the guys that I know that are like that, like, you know, they're very self-determined people, you know?
But I always say it's like, you know, if somebody rejects you for you being your authentic self and your authentic self is based on kindness and compassion and creativity, it's there. You're being protected.
You know, it's
to your benefit
agree.
To be rejected by a terrible person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree at this point. And yeah, I mean, it's like, I don't know. I've spent so much time in my life trying to think about like, oh, you know, what should I say? What should I do in this situation? You know, how will this person react? And kind of trying to game out, like, you know, just how I could, make other people happy, you know? And it's like, ultimately, you know, in my experience, you gotta just like be kind, you know, be honest in the kindest way that you can. And then like the people that, you know, are still in your life, if you're doing that, like they're the ones that are supposed to be there, and the people who don't actually like you for who you are tend to fall away,
you know. But people go nuts when they get horny, you know. And it's wow. like
yeah.
and it's part, especially during this pandemic year, like I've seen some very strange behavior, and one of the things I screaming gay, you know. And so when I'm at the gym, I'm not even like, you know, women look at me and they go, oh honey, you know, this store is closed.
You know? And so they don't shop, but
they
you're not
don't
buying anything.
Buy. They don't buy. They don't knock. They just look at me and they're like, okay. But like, I grew out my hair longer, and my friend Kirthy was telling me that like I looked very heteronormative, and I started finding like women flirting with me, and I was just like kind of laughing and blushing, and I like I just know how to react.
It's because
to it.
Hetero men, their girlfriends insist that they grow their hair out longer, whereas like gay men, most of the time it's like just cut your hair.
We get like, you know, I don't know, what would you describe our haircuts like, but you know they're you know, magazine stuff, right? Fashion runway bullshit. And you know, and I noticed that like some straight men grow their hair long as a signifier to say, hey, this door is open, come on in. You know, and so I had this one woman, and she was like doing like she and I were kind of doing yoga poses on the same mat. And I looked up, and now I'm wearing my mask, and she looks at me and she winks.
Ooh.
And I just started laughing so hard. And then she just thought,
you wouldn't even know what to do.
I had no idea. And so she thought that I was flirting with her, and though she's and it became this escalating, and then she starts asking me for my name, and I'm just like, oh, how are you? You know.
You gotta signify it, right?
I didn't have my rainbow wrist watch at the time that day. I had left it at home, and so, you know, I don't know, part of it is like there's so much awkwardness right now with this pandemic that we just, you know, as Hedwig and the Angry Edge says, we don't know who we are anymore.
Yeah, it's I always feel like so relieved to like find out that someone that I'm trying to flirt with, the guy that I'm trying to flirt with, is gay, because I'm like so nervous about flirting anyway. And the moment I flirt with someone, I'm like so afraid of, you know, like looking like a fool or being rejected or something, that if I just find out that he's gay, I'm like, oh my God, there's a clear reason that he's not interested in me. You know, this is such a relief.
Well, you know, listen, I think people want to be wanted, and people, if you're have a good head on your shoulders, you're going to react to a flirt as a compliment. I think I'd like to think so.
Yeah.
Now, but you know, one thing we have observed in doing this podcast for 16 years, and we've interviewed a lot of people, is the, I guess, per capita, the number one people who purchase gay pornography, adult films, online, is usually women. Mm-hmm. Because there's this like weird, this I wouldn't call it weird, this romantic ideal of equality in a sexual relationship, mm-hmm, that for heterosexual people is, I guess there's a mystery, right?
Well, also too, if you're turned on by men's bodies, you know, get that lady out of here.
And the weirdest thing I've observed in, because if you go like to Sean Cody or like, you know, any of those gay porn sites, there's a section in there that has these guys having sex with women.
And each other.
And each other. Yeah. And so to me, I'm like, and I was like, is this going to turn on gay guys? No, this is designed to turn on heterosexual women who want to watch gay, mm-hmm, porn. And they're the ones, you know, because gay guys will figure out how to steal those.
Well, the video with the women too, that might be the bait too, to get them to start into it. And they're like, well, we're both. And then the other stuff comes
later. It's complicated.
Yeah, it's complicated.
Because, you know,
Oh, I was just going to say, isn't it like a thing in gay porn too, that like guys that are perceived as straight, like that's kind of like a category of gay porn too, with like guys that are like, seem like they look straight or whatever, are having sex with men. I don't know. I actually don't really know that much about porn. Yeah.
Part of it is, I think, you know, when you're identifying as bisexual, you're sort of like, you're gay with benefits. You're bringing all these elements of many worlds into your life. And I think, you know, you're not going to have a lot of hangups in terms of how you come. I would like to think so, you know, and you're bisexual, so maybe you correct me on this, is that you're more open to the idea of being sexual in a, mm-hmm, film for money. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, if, you know, if I'm going to be paid $1,000 to have sex with a guy and a girl, why not do it?
Yeah, I think I don't know. I feel like woefully inexperienced when it comes to like porn, because I literally never watched it.
It's free. Why not watch it?
I guess I'm not like turned on visually. Yeah. I like to read, like, if I'm going to get turned on the internet, I like to read erotic stories or something.
And Nifty.org.
The thing that like really sucks about it is like, a lot of erotic stories are poorly written and edited, and so and it's inconsistent. So you can start with like thinking that, you know, a certain story is going to be really good, but then it is.
I really thought that farmer's daughter was going to get it in the haystack.
Well, it's really hard to masturbate to non sequiturs.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, or it's even spelling errors. That's just like a huge turn off. Sure. Like when you're just reading and there's just like, you know, there's a there confusion, mm-hmm, you know? Like effect and effect. Very frustrating. Oh, that's
there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when we think about the hashtag Me Too movement, a lot of times the first people we kind of think of is David, what's
Weinstein.
Weinstein, and also to Brett Kavanaugh. But I feel like really a lot of it started in the comedy scene with Louis C.K. And you do talk about in your audiobook a bit about the Me Too movement and how it's affected comedy. How can you tell our audience a little bit about your thoughts on what it's like in comedy post Me Too? Because like we've had in Chicago with the comedy scene here, a lot of things like women were getting drugged at open mics, and there was a lot of stuff that's happened. And so I'm wondering how you feel like it's changed the comedy scene nationally, or you know, where you tour.
Well, I think the main thing is it's changed is like the conversations that people have, like the topic of, you know, rape, sexual harassment, power imbalances, like that stuff is now discussed. You know, I think it hasn't changed a lot of things. You know, Louis C.K., he's definitely not like, he has not been returned to his level of like previous glory, because a lot of what Louis C.K. had going for him was he was sort of seen as like this empathetic male feminist. I think like a lot of people forget that he was like considered woke, you know, mm-hmm, and now he's still performing a lot, but he is playing to a mostly right-wing audience at this point. But even like, you know, the dudes that have been accused of, you know, even like worse stuff. Like you got like, there's two comedians in LA, two this year that have been accused very credibly of dating teenagers. In fact, one of them even admitted it, you know. So like basically, you know, having sex with minors, that seems like, you know, pedophilia or whatever seems like a thing that people should kind of be willing to like rally around, like, hey, you know, we shouldn't have that. But, you know, both of those guys are still, you know, performing a lot. And I don't, they have had some career consequences, but their careers definitely aren't like over or whatever. So, you know, it's a thing that has had an impact, but like definitely there's still a problem with, you know, sexual predators in comedy. Like if you look at a lineup from the early 2000s, sometimes like every guy on the show has been accused of sexual assault, you know?
And are you seeing more women comedians like doing shows? Like, are they getting more airplay time?
I think so. I mean, I think that people are starting to have a conversation, like, you know, I think that it's people are kind of not having the like woman in comedy conversation that much anymore. And that was, I started comedy like a bit ago, and that was a thing that people always talked about was like, oh, you know, are women even funny? Like, which you don't see that really happening anymore.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of people are kind of taking it for granted at this point that women can, of course, be comedians, you know?
Well, like Tig Notaro's like, I can't do all the shows.
Yeah.
I can't be in every TV program and movie. Someone like was floating the idea of digitally inserting Tig Notaro into every harmful male figure in Hollywood.
Yeah, that'd be great, actually. Tig is so funny.
She replaced, they digitally edited somebody out recently and put her in instead.
And it works so well, they're like, why not stick her in everything?
Mm.
I mean, but that's part of the thing that we've observed is that, and that's, you know, like I got into stand-up comedy at the age of 18 a long, long time ago. And it was like, you were just terrified to even come out as gay because you were worried you could get punched in the parking lot. And
And
there was a lot of pressure for the setup joke punchline structure. And today, what I'm observing is, you know, a lot of stand-up comedians are like, I don't care if you think this is funny or not. I'm going to tell you how it is. And it's more about, you know, God, I'm blanking out on that famous comedian about the 12 words you can't say on television. George Carlin.
Oh, that's George Carlin. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
George Carlin is like, you know, kind of going in this direction where they're just like, I'm going to speak the truth. And if you think this is entertaining and funny, great. But I'm here more than just to tell jokes. And I think like Hannah Gatsby actually was profoundly influential in changing this approach in how we think about comedy today.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Hannah Gatsby's special Nanette was, I think, it was really good, but also it was very, kind of, it's very typical UK style of comedy, you know, that was like, like in the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, where I think that show got, you know, really known, like the kind of narrative style of comedy where, you know, there was like a story arc and, you know, it's mostly comedy, but there's parts that are sad. Like that's just something that like exists outside of the United States a lot. And I think that people were, you know, sort of first exposed to it, you know, a US audience, but like that's, you know, I think that's been a form for a while, and that it's just like, you know, America being like, oh, we don't really care what the rest of the world is doing, you know.
And so you're saying that like Americans are sort of catching up with the way other people in other countries think about this genre.
I think that it's really tough to tell, right? Because like the past year has changed comedy a lot. Because people have been in their houses a lot. And so there's a bunch of different things that are happening, you know. Like I would not say that the most exciting comedy that's come out in the past year has been like stand up, you know, mostly not. People are doing a lot of like interesting video stuff. You know, people are doing a lot of interesting I mean, I think one of the funniest movies that came out, you know, in 2020, like comedy wise, was like Borat, you know, like Borat 2 or whatever. Like Sacha Baron Cohen is at the top of his game. Like that was, you know, so funny.
Well, stand-up is, in some ways, it's kind of uniquely American, right? I feel like somebody was telling me, like, in France, they don't even really have stand-up comedians. Like, it's just a different style of comedy.
I'm not sure, you know, in France, but I do know that stand-up comedy is huge in the UK. Mm-hmm. It's really big there.
And in Australia,
maybe even more
too.
So than the US. And Australia, yeah. Yeah, and I think that, like, in some ways, it's bigger there.
Oh, yeah, you toured in Australia, didn't you?
How
were the audiences down there? Did you have to do a lot of shrimp on the Barbie jokes, or are they over that?
Well, I did the Melbourne Comedy Festival, and it was really a great experience.
Melbourne's like that's the gay capital of Australia.
Yeah, it felt very San Francisco.
Yeah. Every toilet in Melbourne is a cruisy toilet, I heard.
Yeah,
you can have sex in pretty much any toilet.
Really. Yeah. What are we doing here?
We should really spend a winter in Australia.
Tell me about it. It's like, where's Hugh Jackman from? Oh, let's go there. You know, it's like, yes, aren't we all?
I saw on Twitter that you you tweeted out about the story about Little Prancer, the haunted chihuahua.
Oh, yeah, the headline. I saw that. Let me see. This headline was so wild. Mm-hmm. Good news, Prancer, the 13-pound gremlin chihuahua who hates men and children and was described as a vessel for a traumatized Victorian child, has been adopted by a 36-year-old single lesbian in Connecticut.
Yeah.
Holy shit, there's so much information there. You know?
Well, they described the dog as like, when they first got it, is like after it was shy at first, but then it developed into like all chihuahuas, 50% hate and 50% tremble. And so I guess it just hates children and hates men and just like will bark and like be mean. And the person who was like caring for it and trying to adopt it out was just like, it was nice the first 2 weeks because it just was scared on the couch and then it just turned. But the traumatized, like the vessel for a traumatized Victorian child that now haunts our home is just hysterical. And, you know, that really appealed to people. You know, it's all how you sell it, right?
Yeah, I mean, chihuahuas are just, to me, I know I'm going to get some hate from this, but to me, I'm like, why would anyone get a chihuahua? They're so wound up. Like,
Paris Hilton has had like three of those same dogs and she keeps calling them Tinkerbell.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's like my grandmother used to do that. She had a Lhasa Apso that she called Chiquitita. And I swear to God, at least 10 of those dogs were called Chiquita.
And then it was the nickname was what?
Cooch.
Cooch.
So she would go pick up the grandkids at school. And the dog would run out of the car and she'd go screaming, "Hey, Cooch, Cooch, Cooch."
Well, all of my mother's cats are all named Toddy. But, you know, my friend had a chihuahua and she thought that it would be a good idea to get a little life jacket for her chihuahua and then go whitewater rafting. No. And so she went whitewater rafting with her chihuahua and they went over some waterfall or something like that. And the chihuahua fell out. And so she spent 3 hours sitting next to this waterfall waiting for the chihuahua to pop back up, and it never came up.
Well, this may come as a surprise, but I am a cat person. I like dogs, but they do not have the place in my heart that cats do.
Yeah, cats are fun. How do you feel about birds?
I would never have a pet one. I enjoy watching them. Like if I'm, you know, on a hike or something and there's a beautiful bird that flies by, I love it, but I would not want to bring a bird into my home and put it in a cage. So, doesn't seem like that's where they belong.
Well, so they have this thing. It's almost like American Idol for birds. And there's this guy, he got caught.
It's not a TV show.
Not a TV show. Yeah. This guy got coming in from Guyana and he had 35 Guianan finches, and he had them stuffed inside little hair curlers that you put in your hair, you know, to curl your hair, and, you know, secured in there. And he had them like almost like a Gatling gun, you know how they have those the circular kind of thing, and he had them like wrapped around his legs. So he was, you know, getting them into the country, and I guess he got ratted out because somebody heard them chirping. And what happens is, I guess they bring these birds in and they have these chirp offs. And it's like, instead of like dog fights, it's like these birds, they put them in cages out in the park and they place bets on it. And like which bird is going to have the best chirp or the best tweet.
But it's like American Idol. Yeah. It's a singing competition.
Yeah, it's a singing competition between these two birds. And one of these birds, you know, a little finch that you can buy like at the store. Well, the Guyanese ones are, you know, can fetch up to $10,000 if they sing really well, because you can make money having sing-offs. Could you imagine me like, I'm going to bet on this bird?
So which one's the Kelly Clarkson?
I don't know.
the I guess the Ghanaian finches.
Yeah. That's nuts.
How's that kombucha? You're still on the show, Kate.
Oh, yeah. No, I was just like kind of trying to figure out what's going on with the bird. I don't know.
The birds. You know, there's a study that says that that people like subconsciously value the sound of birds singing so much that it's almost the same as money.
Mm-hmm.
Like in terms of, yeah, that like your happiness is tied to the sound of nature. And when we think about nature, it's bird sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's so wild that has that much of an effect on people's happiness.
If you can have sounds of birds singing in your everyday life, it's amount to about $200 a month.
Really?
Wow. Yeah.
There's a price tag on it.
$200 of birds chirps.
But I used to do that, like when I used to work at a really difficult job that was like a computer desk job, I would play sounds of birds in the rainforest.
Oh.
And it's like, people are like, that makes me want to pee. Cause it was birds chirping and rain. Like, turn that off.
Little did they know you had a piss fetish.
Yeah, well, don't we all? Kate, what in terms of like advice for people who are listening, like to have better relationships? I mean, you have a lot of insights, you know, and certainly Dirtbag Anthropology is chock full of them. What would you like, behavior would you like to see people have with each other, especially heterosexual people?
This is advice that I definitely have trouble taking myself some of the time. But I will say that I think, you know, you got to start with a baseline of two people who are kind and care about communicating well with each other. Like, even if there's not, you know, nobody's perfect at that. Some people definitely have the advantage of having a great childhood. But, you know, you want to be like, both people want to be aiming in the direction of like having something that feels like healthy and functional and communicative and, you know, just kind people. And I've honestly, like, you know, I've hooked up with a lot of jerks because sometimes people who are a little mean are kind of sexy. But I would say, like, in terms of relationship advice, like, you have to start with, like, you got to start with, like, you know, good ingredients if you're going to cook up something that will be good to make it, you know, really dumb metaphor. But then beyond that, like, you know, I think it's like what you were saying earlier, which is like, I'm going to butcher your quote, but like, basically, if somebody doesn't value you and they reject you, like they're doing you a favor. Like the person has to value you. Like if somebody doesn't value you, if somebody doesn't appreciate you, there's nothing that you can do that is going to make them change their mind. Like, you gotta just cut your losses and move on. You will never convince anybody to love you. Believe people if they say that they're not into it, you know?
I learned this from one of our early guests. She said one time, man's rejection is God's protection. And to me, it was like something that really stuck with me because it's, you know, of course, she was talking about this idea of when someone says no to you, it can hurt a lot, but it opens up a lot of relationships and opportunities in the future for good things to come into your life. And I noticed that a lot of like terrible people say that they're nice guys. I'm a nice guy. Why can't I have a good man or woman in my life? You know? And I'm just like, who determined you were a nice guy?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a nickname. You can't give yourself the title of nice guy, it has to be given to you, you know?
And usually people who say they're nice guys are the worst people.
Yeah, that's, well, a lot of the time they mean, like, you know, a lot of the time they mean that they're like, trying to
Yeah, they're indulging you. I'll indulge you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But I was like, don't you want to be nice?
It's strings attached, right? Like, that it's like a thing where, like, yeah, they'll be nice, but it's because of some secret expectation.
Yeah. And when you aren't, that secret expectation is not met, I will not be nice. The one that scares me on the dating profiles the most is, I don't know if this happens in the hetero world, but in the gay ones, is people who describe themselves as sane and sordid. And I'm just like, I know that can't be true.
Yeah. Or people who are like, no drama. You know, it's like, if you've had enough drama in your relationships that you need to put no drama on your Tinder profile, you're the one causing the drama.
Well, Fausto told me something a while ago, because I described something as drama. He's like, you know, it's not very nice or empathetic to describe somebody's feelings as drama, because drama, you know, is false. And like, you know, it's theater. These are people's feelings. You know,
well, your feelings matter, but at the same time, it's like, I may not be the person who is best capable or equipped to handle your feelings.
Yeah.
And this is like one thing I've observed, especially in, you know, Western culture. They proceed through life as if everybody is a customer service representative for them. And they're always like, I want to speak to the manager why you won't have sex with me. And you're like, what?
The manager of sex. I want to be the manager of sex.
I was like, I'm sorry, we can't do that for you. Have a nice day.
Yeah.
So Kate, the world is opening up. Are you doing stand-up in front of live audiences right now? Or is that yet to come? What's happening with that?
I'm doing a lot of outdoor shows right now.
Do you bring an umbrella to every show?
Well, the weather's been pretty nice, but I am doing some outdoor shows, and I definitely have some tour dates booked this summer, which, like, fingers crossed, it seems like most people are going to be fully vaccinated by then. Mm-hmm. So let's see, but I'm definitely expecting to be doing a lot of stand-up in the back half of this year, which will be amazing.
Well, I hope to see you when you come to Chicago, because you actually lived in Chicago for a little while, huh?
I love Chicago. Yeah. It is so much fun. It's one of my favorite places to do stand-up.
Yeah, and you were a mime here? Is that what did you do when you were here? It was
experimental theater.
Experimental theater?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So I went to DePaul.
Okay. For undergraduate? Like your whole degree there?
No. I went to a year of MFA program at DePaul, and I left / got kicked out. Definitely one of those you can't fire me, I quit situations. Just a bad match all around.
What were you doing that got you into conflict with them?
Well, it wasn't really a conflict. It was just more like, it was just kind of an ongoing like culture clash. Like, my class was like very bro-y. It was like all of these guys that really like sports a lot, and like, just
experimental,
you know,
theater guys like sports.
Yeah, I mean, that was the weirdest thing about it, because I was like, I didn't go get like a master's degree in theater because I wanted to hang out with bros. Like, what the and I think what was going on in at least a couple of those instances, that those people were closet gay. I think there was a couple gay people, and the closet gay people, there were some women that were alcoholics. It was like 8 of the cattiest people that I've ever met in my life. Actually, I'll say like 7, because one of them was really nice. 2 of them were really nice.
Bro, we got to break down the boundaries between performer and audience.
Yeah, it was brilliant. It was right, just like, I hated Cubs it game. So much. I'm so glad that I liked living in Chicago, but I'm so glad that I didn't continue with that program, because... Oh, man, there's nothing better than leaving a situation that you're not supposed to be in.
Well, this is the end of this podcast, so.
Well, Kate, I hope you enjoyed your time with us.
It was so much fun. I love talking to you guys. Thank you so much.
Come back anytime. Thank you very much. And, you know, best of luck with your audiobook, which is available on audible.com.
For free, actually.
Is it for free?
You don't have to pay a penny, honey. Yeah, you can get it.
Yeah, no, it is. It's Audible Plus. So free with any Audible subscription. Okay.
So if you're in there, you can listen and enjoy it, and it's pretty good. It's great.
It's great.
Thank you so much. Wonderful. I really appreciate it. This was a blast.
Of course. Thank you for coming on, and we'll see you in the
future.
Thanks
for having me.
Take care, Kate. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Kate Willett lives in San Francisco.
No, she lives in Brooklyn.
Oh, Kate Willett lives in Brooklyn, New York. Check out Dirtbag Anthropology on Audible or wherever fine audiobooks are found. But it's an Audible exclusive, so you can't find anywhere but Audible.
Okay, so yeah, listen there.
Yeah, we'll have the link in the show notes so you can click on it and you can dived in deep to the world of men. Men. I love men.
What was that? Brooke Shields?
It was Brooke Shields. Gloria Swanson.
Morgan Fairchild.
It was the actress who played I Dream of Jeannie, Barbara Eden. And they were like doing this weird little musical number where they're all like singing.
Was it for the Oscars or something?
No, it was for the Emmys.
Oh,
I believe.
For the Emmys?
And they're all talking about men.
Men.
And Gloria Swanson was like, that she got like sexual fantasies about Woody Allen.
Yikes.
And Barbara Eden and Brooke Shields, she's fantasizing about Michael Jackson. And so it was a list of ideal men in Hollywood. John Travolta, she was fantasizing about. Wow. That didn't age too well.
I guess not, because you know a couple of those guys have been accused of a lot of terrible things.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Did you ever, as a child, fall in love with a kid in school and
so
you discovered that was a wrong thing to happen?
So when I was in first grade, the girls were chasing me and this kid and in the playground, you know? And I remember we kind of got away from them and we were hugging. We're kind of like whatever because we had gotten away from the girls. And I remember kissing him. And I don't think it was like on the cheek or something like that. And I feel like maybe there was some kind of like big deal made out of that. And maybe I may have said something at home about that. And the next year I was, they put me into Catholic school.
Wow.
Yeah. So
they're like, well, if he likes boys, wait till he meets Father the priest.
I have to say no priest bothered me until I got into high school.
Wow.
But, and then I had another neighbor, his name was Alan Walters. If you're out there anywhere,
Alan, still have a crush on you.
I had a crush on him and we were good friends. And then he moved and, you know, I never thought I'd see him again. And then he came back like a couple months later because I think his parents had to come back to the house for something like that.
Yeah.
He came at the door and it was just, we didn't get to spend much time with him, but I just remembered how my heart just like, you know, just filled with like, oh, you know. So I often wonder, like, where is Alan now? He was a cute little kid, so I assume he grew up to be a very handsome man.
Well, you know, I grew up in Puerto Rico in the 1980s, and at that time period, there were families from all around the world moving to the island because their businesses were relocating families there.
Yeah, because they could have access to the American economy. Well,
it was also a tax haven
as
well.
Haven, yeah.
And so I was friends with kids from all around the world. And one kid that I had a really close friendship was named Benji, like the dog.
Oh.
And I ran into him in the grocery store one day. And I ran up to him. I was so happy to see him. I gave him a big hug and a kiss on the cheek. And Benji panicked. And he said, "Mom, Fausto tried to kiss me." And I was like, uh-oh. And I ran away. And I thought, you know, and our friendship was never the same. And then I think it was like in third grade or fourth grade, I got a pen pal letter from Benji. And he's like, "Remember me? Here's a photo of myself. Would you like to be pen pals?" I'm like, "No, you broke my heart."
Oh.
Where is Benji?
Where's Benji now?
Benji, the two of us need look no more.
I want to remind folks that we can't do this podcast without your support. So if you're not a Plus member yet, sign up at feastoffun.com/plus because your contribution to the show is what makes the show happen. We wouldn't be able to talk to fantastic people like Kate if it weren't for you.
Savor each and every mouth-watering morsel of Feast of Fun. Completely without ads. Feastoffun.com/plus. We're on Patreon, honey. Give us some money, honey. Mm-hmm. Give us a tip.
Venmo at Feast of Fun.
Yeah.
Cash App.
Or the whole 9 inches. Slip into my DMs, Fausto Furnos on Instagram.
Mark Fillion.
And we love chatting with you guys. And we love having Kate Willett. Again, the book. It's an audio book.
It is an audio book. I don't think there's a hard copy of the book. I think it was produced as an audio book because, you know, Audible does audiobooks.
And, you know, imagine that if it's successful,
if you wanted to, you might be able to record it into a transcription machine, and then you could just read it.
And that is Dirtbag Anthropology, available only as an Audible exclusive. Look at the links on Feast of Fun in the notes. Scroll down if you're listening on your podcast player. The link is there as well. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.